on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
And thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Night. I trust your team won the cricket. The Aussies don't have to have it their way all the time. This evening, after a week in which all Australians have been brought a little closer to what loss and tragedy really mean, we're going to spend a little time with one or two of those big questions flowing out of the events of the past week. We'll be struggling with what emerges from the tragic events. How does one make sense of tragedy? What happens to faith in such events? And how and when do we approach those who may be in need of assistance? Well, joining us will be the Reverend Stephen Holmes, Anglican priest at Kinglake in Victoria, Father Chris Monaghan of the Yarra Theological Union, Stephen Robinson, author of Ministry in Disaster Settings, and Steve Said, an advisor on critical incidents with the Catholic Education Office. You too can join us, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222. How to make sense of tragedy and disaster. It's a question that's bedeviled all of the great religious traditions, but more than that, it's a question that comes home when we stare into the eyes of those who had to face the ultimate tragedy. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia, Radio Australia, and via the web to the world. The world has watched as Victoria burned this week, and it's not an exaggeration to say so. All around the world, people have taken an interest in the tragedy that befell the citizens of Kinglake, Kinglake West, Marysville, and each of us have been touched in our own ways by it, either with friends in Victoria, family in Victoria, or perhaps even like myself, with association with one of the areas that was touched by the fires. But it raises wider questions such as, why do bad things happen to good people? Questions about how do survivors react with the phenomenon known as survivor guilt? How do we begin to rebuild lost and broken lives? And what's it mean for our community? Well, to help us struggle with some of those questions, we're joined this evening by the Reverend Steve Holmes, the Anglican priest at Kinglake in Victoria, Father Chris Monaghan of the Yarra Theological Union in Melbourne, Stephen Robinson, author of Ministry in Disaster Settings, and Steve Said, an advisor on critical incidents with the Catholic Education Office. Gentlemen, welcome to you all. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Holmes, as a priest faced with disaster in your parish, what was the first thing that was said to you as you walked into that scene of such desolation?
I actually was numbness when I first when I got down to the triage centre at the showgrounds. Just watching the people come in at that stage, of course, it was mainly firefighters coming in who'd been injured. That was about 10 o'clock, 10:30. One particular family was there also just lost, and was at that stage there was quite a number of chaplains, so there was a lot of us there. So I wasn't actually sort of talking directly right there. It wasn't until 12:30 when I actually went up the hill with the police to actually Kinglake Township itself, that I began to really come face to face with what had happened. And going up the mountain, and took us about an hour to get up there, and it was just like an inferno. The whole mountain seemed to be on fire. Well, it was on fire. So, and when I came to my first person, who had lost her father and lost her business, and she explained to me that she'd lost her mum just recently, and now she'd lost her father, and she had nothing to show, and she was beginning to show signs of anger. You know, she said she was a lapsed Catholic, and why? You know, the usual question, began to ask the question why, and that was probably what met me first. And that was probably the one person that sticks in my mind who began to ask that question immediately, whereas the remainder of the people, I stayed up till 3:30 in the morning, and the rest of the people, it was just numb. They were just glad to be there together, you know, glad to have someone else with them to talk to, glad to have survived. That was what I was faced with.
You're not only faced with the challenge of why coming from other people, but of course the impact that that has on your own sensibility. That is, you have to be asking that question, why yourself?
I guess so. I guess at that time it's not a question I ask, and I suppose I'm just thinking about my fellow citizens, God's children, and what I saw was that the image of God, though it may be hidden sometimes in people, yet I saw it coming out in the way they hung together, way they helped each other, and so that gave me strength. And as I said today in the service, I have a very strong sense of God's presence in my own life, and a very strong sense of the sureness of the resurrection. And while I can't give answers to a lot of these questions, nice, neat, wrapped up, none of us can, I don't believe. But yet, somewhere in the cross, somewhere in the resurrection, I find strength to keep going and to keep serving these lovely people who have shown immense courage and who have come through such trying times.
Father Chris Monaghan, let me bring you in here. Stephen Holmes, in describing that first encounter, brings us face to face with the paradox of such situations: the immediate question of the tragedy, why and why me, and then the other side of that coin, that in suffering somehow one sees the image of the crucified God. This is a paradox here that that has been wrestled with for a very long time by very many people.
Certainly, it leaves us all struggling, doesn't it? I mean, we see the good that has come. Obviously, the suffering is something that we would not want anyone to undergo at all. And yet, this, like the new life that comes in after a bushfire, we actually see this enormous generosity, this outpouring of love and community, which is, I wouldn't say it's disturbing, but it's very hard for any of us to have a firm grip on. And I think Stephen has spoken about it really, really beautifully. That was it, Stephen? Was it yourself that said that even though you'd burnt down the building of your church, it hadn't destroyed the church?
Yes.
Is that true? Was that your words?
Yes, absolutely. And because again, I came back and saw that it's the people, the essence. It's the gathering of the people, isn't it? The gathering of the people of God and the community, which really is the church when it's all said and done.
Mm. And I think, sorry, John.
Yeah, other people might say, though, gee, it's a pretty tough way for God to show his hand, you know, that you have to go through that in order to appreciate him.
Oh, for sure. And I suppose that's where we all our theories, as Stephen has already pointed out, just seem to stumble when we come across the suffering of good people. I mean, nobody could understand. I know we've heard some pastors, I suppose, well-meaning, but talking in terms of somehow this is a punishment on people. This is the sort of theory that I can't possibly ascribe to.
Well, let's just talk about that for a second, because we can deal with it very briefly. For those of you who don't know, a pastor, Danny Nalia, associated with Catch the Fire, a Pentecostal ministry in Melbourne, said that these bushfires were a direct result of his message in a dream from God, that God said the bushfires were a result of people's attitude to abortion, the Holocaust of abortion. Seems that there's a view on his theology there as well as on his attitude to the world that one could take. But how does this sit with you, Chris, as a theologian?
Well, I suppose we've always had the sense of one of the ways of interpreting suffering is suffering as a consequence of not being in right relationship scripturally. What the story in Genesis is in a nutshell, isn't it? That Adam and Eve is telling the story of the human family, that because of our lack of being in right relationship with one another, right relationship with God, sin comes as perhaps a punishment or a consequence of not being in right relationship. That's one part of one answer. But to think that the poor people of King Lake and Marysville had somehow or other brought this upon themselves. I suppose this is within the scriptures themselves. There's this tension that goes on. You can look at the book of Deuteronomy talking about the punishments that will come upon the people if they don't listen to what Moses has asked them to do. And yet, if you read through Deuteronomy at another level, you can see that all the time God is opening up another surprising opportunity that somehow or other, while even if you thought that God had some right to punish people, that God doesn't exercise that.
Stephen Holmes, how did you feel when you heard that?
I didn't actually hear it. This is the statement you're talking about from the other pastor.
Yeah.
Look, I didn't actually hear. I mean, I'll be honest, I hadn't listened to the news or radio or TV until tonight, the first time since Saturday. So I've sort of been out of the picture of that.
Just doesn't fit, does it, mate?
I find it a struggle. I mean, I think perhaps a little bit more reflection is required. And I think Stephen was right there to say what he did, and there was a tension. And but you know, yeah, I think I'd want to think about this one a lot more before I actually come in on the side of clearly coming down black and white.
Well, let me bring a couple of other contributors into this conversation. Two people who've had to deal with the issues that are more immediate for people. Stephen said you're somebody who's worked with the Catholic Education Office on the issue of trauma and how people face it. You've particularly looked at dealing with it in the context of school situations and shock and trauma at schools. We've got a traumatised community. You hear some people say, oh, look, we should rush straight off to those communities and sort of get them into counselling straight away. And I heard somebody else on the news say, no, look, it's going to take some people 12 months before they're ready for counselling. What's the general rule here, Steve, when you face traumatic situations such as this? What should we be offering people?
I think the general rule is that as human beings, we really do have a lot of inner resources, and I think the thing is to draw on those resources. And even young children, adolescents, it's also really good to give them the opportunity to find their own resilience, to draw on those resources rather than smother them. Having said that, I think one of the most important things is reassurance and to provide a sense of safety. Obviously, the young people who have actually lived through the fires, that's incredibly important. But right around Australia, we have young people who are watching images on TV who are fantasising that their house might be next, that mum or dad or a teacher might be the next person to be affected by this. So there's a whole lot of different levels, but I think the most important thing is the reassurance of that safety.
We need to be sensitive to the fact that some kids might take it badly, but that generally kids are pretty resilient. In some ways more resilient than parents, actually, are they not?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And they have their own ways of coping with it. And I think as adults, it's difficult to take a step back and let them find their own ways of coping with it, whether it's through their friendships, whether it's through their music or drawing. And that's difficult because we naturally want to protect them and care for them. But we can actually inhibit that sort of very natural process of making sense of things and coming through this in their own way.
In some ways, we saw it in some of the images, the photographs in the newspapers of kids just in the last couple of days, of a young girl pushing a scooter along the road through the burnt-out wreckage, or other kids playing cricket. There is a sense in which kids, you can get on with life.
Oh, absolutely.
There's optimism there that's just built in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think let that happen. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful part of human nature. Mm. And let it happen.
Yeah, can I
Stephen Holmes, yes, please.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was just noticing my children, because I've got three. One's 18, one's almost 16, and the youngest one's 13. And they've had friends at school who've, you know, have lost, you know. And I'm just talking briefly and watching them, and I noticed one thing that really was good was to have their friends come over, their school friends come together. They took the day off, they come over, and they actually participated in the operation that we're running here, sorting clothes, being part of the relief effort, and, you know, they really pitched in. And, And my little girl said, you know, she was really glad that her, A, her friends come and joined her, that she could be with her friends and actually do something. And I don't know, I guess that's part of therapy, that's part of, you know, working it through as, you know, with their peers, helping them. I guess that's the first we, most of us do, don't we? Talk to our peers, we rely on our peers for, at least in adults, I think we do. I'm not an expert in children, so I would be happy to be to sort of someone to say any more about that.
No, that's you're absolutely right. You know, two things there, two points. We are relational beings, and we make sense of terrible crises like this in relationships, and young people are no different to adults. And the second thing it raises, of course, is we want to do something. Even young people want to do something, and that's where it's great that they have an opportunity to provide some pocket money if they wish to. I know in schools, children are writing cards, and they're doing something active because that, you know, it enables them to express some of that incredible distress that they're feeling quite vicariously from watching those images and hearing the radio day after day.
Chris Monaghan, what do you say when people ask you bluntly, how do you see God in something so directly evil? We have looked into the face of hell here.
Well, I suppose the first thing I'd say is I wouldn't have any answers to, and certainly no simple answers to that. I've been thinking about it ever since, all through this these days, and when I was asked to prepare for tonight, I thought, well, what answer do I really have when it comes down to it? And
what answer do you arrive at yourself? I guess.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it's 27 years as a priest and dealing with people's grief and suffering all those years. I suppose the answer for me is that I find that really it might sound, well, not trite, but simplistic, but the answer is in the silence in prayer, that somehow that sense of God's presence enables me to have the strength to think that evil doesn't have the last word. And interesting, just what you were talking about just before there about children and adults needing to be with others. So something of a theological reflection would be, well, we've got the same thing happening at the foot of the cross and when Jesus dies, that Mary and the beloved disciple, they huddle together, they get through the best that they can, and we all see that. But when someone asks you, you know, well, I can remember not so long ago a fellow I'd had done the funeral for, his grandmother and then his mother, and he said, well, Chris, you know, don't take it personally, but I really don't want to see you for a while. And I said, I can understand the circumstances. Every time we meet, it's for a funeral. What can any of us ever say? I think watching Shane Warne there during the last few days when he went up there, and there was one fellow, he said, well, just, you know, keep your chin up. And he said, how can I? I've lost my wife and my daughter. And Shane Warne did what any of us, I hope, would do, would be reach out in love and compassion and friendship and just try to be with one another. Sometimes it's in the silence, isn't it? When we have no words and certainly no easy way of taking away, certainly no magic wands, nothing to take away the pain of people that's been visited upon them so suddenly and without any warning. No, it's a difficult thing for all of us. I don't think it would ever go away for us.
Stephen Robinson, you're the author of a book called Ministry in Disaster Settings, which you've looked at the stress that is placed on those who have to care for the victims and respond to the questions that victims ask in this situation.
That's right.
The toll on those who go through this as chaplains, counsellors, police officers, fireys, must be quite considerable.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yes, in fact, where that book came from was it was my doctoral thesis, and it was stimulated by the fact I've been involved in chaplaincy and in terms of emergency ministry of different types, and came across numbers of conversations with people and recognised that it had changed them, and they were still carrying scars of their involvement in that, and quite often in many of those cases they were so busy doing the caring that, you know, the old question of who cares for the carers at the end of the day. And I found some people that had 10 years later on, following a major disaster and from their involvement in it, people hadn't come alongside adequately, and in many ways they were still a little bit warped from it, I suppose, and damaged by it. But recognising that there is going to be a cost from some sort of involvement alongside traumatised people. You are going to, in some way, carry something of it.
And is it best to ask the questions or to put the questions behind you? I mean, I guess it differs for each person, does it? For some people, just getting on with it is good enough, or for others, no, you've got to actually confront the questions because they go to really deep...
I'm not sure. I think for the people I spoke to, it was some time after the event, and they had all worked through those questions. They had all seen how it applied in their life, and they'd come to understand that. That they couldn't understand at all, and yet each of them that I'd spoken to, their faith had in some ways altered, in some cases got very much stronger. They'd come to some resolutions about it all, but within it there was this ongoing hope, which is more than just wishing. It's actually this really deep gut knowledge that there is more than this, and that God is a God of resurrection, and that there is... and that he is good. There's this overarching sense and knowledge in that, despite what they've seen.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We're talking about the aftermath of the fires. For those personally concerned, for those ministering to those affected by the fires, what are the questions that have to be answered? Not just the immediate questions of where do I go to get... bread and food and shelter, but the questions about where do I go for help? What are the questions that confront those who have ministered to those who are in need of help? Are there life-changing questions? Are there questions that arise for you about fundamental belief in the goodness of the world, the goodness of God? Does God exist? 1-300-800-222. Join the conversation. 1-300-800-222. The other thing I should say here, of course, for those in Queensland, floods, droughts and flooding rains has never been more true than in the last couple of weeks. And across Queensland, for the best part of a month, people have been grappling with the frustrations of homes that have been ruined twice over. The people of Bourke just in the last couple of days. So wherever you are in Australia, if you feel these questions need to be answered and challenged, give us a call, 1-300-800-222 on ABC Radio around Australia.
Sunday Night with John Cleary.
And on Sunday night, we're asking questions about the consequences of the bushfires for those who've participated, for those who've counselled those who've participated, and just for those of us who may encounter somebody who's been affected by the fires, how should we respond? Chris said, Stephen said, there was something a moment ago that we touched on in speaking with Stephen Robinson about the dealing with those after the fire, those who counsel and are affected by it. And it goes back to when we were talking about the little kids and their responses. Adults can respond differently. Adults, the adrenaline's up, you're immediately caught up with the frustrations after realising that your world's crashed around you. You've then got to start putting it back together. You've got to somehow deal with getting somewhere to live. You've got to somehow deal with the myriad of red tape, with insurance, with all of that. That sort of busy routine must take you through a whole lot of steps that could keep you tied up for, say, 6 months before you crash.
Yes, that's correct. And that can be very difficult for somebody who, long time after the event, might be going through a fair degree of personality change, of not understanding why they're so they're getting so tired, why their moods are so different. And for others, it's very difficult to understand that because it seems so long after the event. And I think that's one of the real problem areas. I think we have to look out for each other, and we have to be aware that this isn't going to go away overnight. We all have an emotional range within which we operate, and for some, their emotional range might have them kind of get through this with a fair degree of resilience. For others,
so you don't press people and say, "I think you should talk about this."
No.
You don't. You just allow it to flow naturally.
Absolutely. I think you observe loved ones, you observe people you know, because you know their normal behaviour patterns. But you certainly let people do things in their own time and their own space.
Yes. It's not the how do you feel, and somebody says, all right, and you say, well, how do you really feel?
No,
I mean, this is not the...
No, no. As I said earlier, I think, you know, trust that we are, you know, we are capable of our own healing. It's for loved ones to facilitate that healing, not to impose it on us. And I worry when I see images of, you know, somebody beginning to cry and... The arm is immediately, you know, they're immediately enveloped. I think the message that can give is don't cry. You know, I mean, whose need is it for that person not to cry? The person who is distressed, or mine as the person who wants to sort of console them, make them better.
Stephen Holmes, as a priest on the front line, how do you deal with that that issue of when to intrude and when not to intrude?
Yeah. I think you pick up the vibe. You learn a sixth sense, I think. But you know, even the best can put the foot in it and make a mistake. And I guess in general, though, I think I just take a soft approach and let them listen to them. Just listen, and I think in general it comes out, as someone said, that you're not going to pressure them, and it's just being available, being there. I mean, I will go and see someone for the third time already, just to pop in and just because they're staying already there with friends, or friends have taken them in. So I'll just pop in probably tomorrow and just sit with them and have a cup of tea and keep that relationship, keep the door open, and basically relying on God to a certain extent to touch them and prepare me, and you know, I pray very hard that I might listen and have discernment,
but not intrude.
I would never encourage anyone to do that. Yeah. You know, because I think... absolutely not.
Stephen Robinson, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I suppose it's a tagline in a sense. It's an understanding that's used in chaplaincy, which is called the ministry of presence. And that's it's describing just that, the idea of just not needing to say anything. It's just the very fact that you're there with somebody and often identified as an agent of God, that it is actually just the incarnational presence that is vitally important, and quite often words are intrusive, and you don't try to even begin to work through the whys and whatever at that point of time. It's just that you care enough to be there for them. Mm. Yeah.
Stephen Holmes, let me ask you one other question about intrusion, and that's the role of the media in things like this. The role of the media, for the rest of Australia, the role of the media is vital. For the rest of the world, the role of the media has been vital. That is, in telling this story in such a way as people outside of Kinglake can understand the size of this disaster and the depth of this disaster. Yet for people in the eye of the storm, the role of the media can be exactly the opposite. It can be intrusive, in your face, exploitative. Let me wring the next tear out of the person. Have you felt the tension of that?
I saw that in motion, actually. On was it Sunday morning at the showgrounds? There was a freelance or journalist or cameraman, whatever. And yes, I think he probably did overstep the mark. He probably wasn't sensitive enough. He didn't read situation. And I think his particular approach at the time, you know, he was after that quick shot. And I actually think he did himself a disservice. But worse still, I think he did his profession a disservice. And he was rightly asked to leave and taken off the grounds, you know. But however, I think that, you know, I've had Compass with me, a guy from Compass, ABC Compass with me, and very sensitive guy, just keeps there in the background. And I think he reads people very well, and for him, he's not out to make a political statement or to find someone that he can use to pick up and follow up some political witch hunt that's been going on. I think that's where people really, really get angry, is when they're approached, like I had a guy today, my warden actually, who saved his health in Kinglake. And now he was approached by media outlets after the service, asked the question, do you think, the class action, for instance, should be? Well, he had something to say about that. But I think those things are where people really, you know, really get themselves uptight, and I agree with them too. But where the media are genuinely seeking to, you know, tell a story, and are sensitive, I think in most cases, you know, people understand that their loved ones want to know they're all right. They do understand, but, you know, there's a time and a place, and I think it comes back to our ethics, comes back to our professional standards, that we have to realise in situations like this, it's not the time to try and get that quick shot that might get the splash on the paper.
1300 800 222. We're going to take your calls in just a moment, but there's one other question we'll ask of Father Chris Monaghan of the Yarra Theological Union. Chris, in this, you're a Passionist priest. You've come out of a tradition within the Catholic Church which spends a lot of time reflecting theologically on the meaning of suffering, the suffering, the passion of Christ on the cross. There is a mystery here, is there not, that particularly in Christianity, which is, because of the way Christ dies, Christianity reflects on this a lot, how that somehow in the worst of situations is where in some ways God is closest.
Very much so. And I think it's for us it's always very holy ground, isn't it? You've got Jesus himself on the cross crying out, my God, why have you abandoned me? And for us, it's always been a very deep invitation to part of the answer is for us when we look at any suffering is to say that, well, where's God in this? Well, for us, and certainly within our tradition, it's to see that, in fact, that God isn't distant. God has shared in a most profound way by entering into our pain very personally. As St. Paul would say, you know, this Jesus who loved me and gave himself for me. So what was a brutal act, a violent act, in some ways a very senseless act, political and whatever, in the case of Jesus' own death, that we see that that God is working mysteriously and profoundly to bring about new life. Our own founder, St. Paul of the Cross, in the early 1700s, it was in a time when people were very, very much neglected in terms of pastoral care. And his answer was really to see that in the face of cynicism and a loss of faith, I suppose, in the church at that time in Italy, in Tuscany and elsewhere, was to turn up, surprisingly, with bare feet and a cross on his shoulder and say that, look, God does care. It was radical, and in his time, it's always going to be a radical invitation. Obviously, not everyone can accept it, but certainly his message was that the passion of Jesus is the most overwhelming sign of God's love, and it is a deep, deep paradox for any of us. And when suffering touches us, I suppose we can understand his suffering out of love as sacrifice for us. I suppose what we do then when people that we love hurt, where is God found in all of that? And I was thinking about our own constitutions as a religious congregation, as an order, as Passionists, and our own constitutions don't allow us just simply to say, okay, Jesus has been there and done it all, that in fact following him leads us to be intimately connected in our own lives to removing the cause of suffering where we can for others.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Time to take your calls. First, we're going to say hi to Ron on the Sunshine Coast. Ron, thanks for joining us. What would you like to say?
Yes, I'm just wondering where Sodom and Gomorrah fits into this. I was brought up in a Christian faith, and for the last 19 years I haven't been practicing going to regular church services, but I'm just wondering, my father used to always preach about Sodom and Gomorrah. And I feel I'm fast approaching the 70 years and 10. I just wonder how I feel that the politicians and the clergy have left us down badly.
What do you think? There is room for a more of a sense of judgment in the world.
Well, that's right. I think that the clergy should be preaching more towards, you know, the everyday being accountable for our actions and whatever.
Well, let's get Chris Monahan's response to that. This this idea of responsibility that we have to exercise in life, Chris Monahan, is somehow being monitored by God, and we will be judged. Accountability.
Accountability. Well, it's there, isn't it? We're called to be responsible, and I suppose with regard to Sodom and Gomorrah, that's part of those first 12 chapters of Genesis, telling the story, and it's a sad story of us losing touch with what we were being created to be, and sin and violence in the world.
It comes down to this idea of whether God is a God of vengeance in any sort, though, doesn't it? This whole sort of idea that in somehow that events in the natural world are somehow connected to God's will, you do get into questions of punishment and vengeance, just as Danny Nalia did in his statement about abortion.
Yeah, sure.
Is it a healthy way to go?
Well, healthy. So is it Ron is our caller,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can understand Ron's weariness, thinking, well, are we sold out on human responsibility? Certainly not. I don't think that's true at all. But maybe we're trying to, at this stage, get a little bit more balance back, because a lot of people have gone through many centuries of Christianity feeling somehow or other that... that God is a vengeful God, and I suppose this is the thing, isn't it? If suffering comes along, is its punishment? Well, for many centuries, the Christians we've tried to reflect on: if God is a God of justice, if God is a God of taking our choices seriously, well, yeah, accountable. When and where? Yeah, sorry.
We get Stephen Holmes' observations on that just quickly. Stephen, how do you feel when people say to you, "Well, yeah, how do you see God in this? Is this God punishing us with these flames?"
I suppose I don't. Well, take the situation of the lady right at the night making, sort of not directly making that statement, but inferring something like. And my comment too was not to run away from it, but my judgment on the night was, I don't think tonight's the night. I think we need. I said to her, and friends agreed with me, I want to take care of you. I want to get you through this night, and then let's pursue it as when. When the raw emotion and the whole is a little bit past, and let's come back to it and sit down and pray, just be together and talk. Then I'll talk. But yeah, no. Of course, there's accountability. There's none of us. I don't believe any of us who take the Christian faith seriously run away from that. After all, I face death at any time of my life. I guess as I was in communion today, of course, the confession, and I'm well aware of my life and holiness before God, and one day we all will be judged, that's a reality. I guess for me personally, when I'm talking to individuals at the moment, I'm not choosing to... I don't take that line... right now to say, you know, this is because think of that God's angry with you or something. I prefer to try and bring people through that and then help them to come to by the Spirit's touch of their life through perhaps my words, my help, through others, draw them into a new place to pick up on the obviously for many people there's a God awareness has arisen in there in many of them, you know, even when that lady asked, yet when I prayed with her as a Catholic, she crossed herself and she entered into prayer. And so there was a dimension. There was a sort of, there's two things going on in her life, and I was keen to bring forth the positive rather than to dwell on.
And to allow people to work them through themselves at that point. Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. And you know, and then bring her into a relationship, a renewed relationship. Remember I said she said she was a lapsed Catholic, and, you know, my whole thing was to try and be there, take a longer-term view, not just a, well, you've got to take a long-term view, because people take time in their journey.
Mm. And I'll just see if Stephen, either of the Stephens in the studio here, have got anything to say. Yes, on that. Stephen said here.
Yes, I see it as a great tragedy. I don't see it as the wrath of God. I think it's happened to good people. Terrible things happen in life. It's a terrible tragedy. I don't see it as God's wrath.
I think there's another angle on there as well, which is that people's responsibility is a major part of it, whether that be through a mission, through there's questions about, you know, what started the fire, or whether it was intentional. Either way, it could well be.
Yes, human agencies are involved at every level here, aren't they?
Did God make someone light a fire? I would question that.
Yes. Let's go
where
to...
We get, sorry, John. Yes. But where we get the problem, I suppose, is that not so much did God cause it, but why did people ask the question, well, why did God allow it to happen?
Yeah, sure.
And they're questions that we work through. Let's go to... Thanks, Ron, for your question. We'll go to Jody on the Sunshine Coast, who's got an observation on this question. Jody.
Hello there, John. How are you? Look, yes, I immediately rang through when one of your guests earlier in the beginning of the evening mentioned that he hadn't been listening to the news or the
that was Stephen Holmes.
Yes, and he didn't really want to come out and pass comment on the gentleman who said that the fire was the result of our people with abortion issues and so forth. And I mean, I just don't see this identity of that we call God as being full of vengeance and wrath and, you know, being angry with us here, as to sort of say, well, look here, cop this, you lot down there this week, you know, I just think about this. I mean, this identity, this image we have of God is just not like that, you know. It's, and I just can't understand that this comes up and it's not, the goodness is not reinforced, or the caring or the loving is not reinforced. It's the sitting on the fence, if you like to say, in just layman's terms of, you know, well, yes, maybe we, you know, we do need to take responsibility for our own lives down here. Yes, we are accountable. Yes, we, you know, those of us who do have faith, we will be accountable at the time of our death and whatever.
Jody, thanks for your observation. We've got lots of calls on the board. I'm going to have to move on. Thank you for calling us.
Thank you.
Sunday night. We're going to say hi quickly to two or three people just before we get some further comments. Let's say good evening to Graham in Devonport in Tasmania. Graham, you wanted to say something.
Yes, I think it's a matter of timing on the Danny Naylor statement. That statement was issued last October in the Sydney Morning Herald. And then
it was reissued this week as a press release.
The press release was last October.
No, it came onto my desk this week as a press release, so just to get some facts on that.
That was to try and correct what had gone on with the other press release, because the Herald has just come out an undated statement saying that he attributed it to abortion. And...
Anyway, look, that's not...
That was by virtue of a prophecy last October.
Yeah, look, I don't want to go particularly down that line. I was only going to use it as an illustration, so we will move on that question. The other question we have to raise is how people are being extraordinarily generous with this with their response. I mean, there's just been a marvellous outpouring of compassion from the Australian community generally. And I've got Gary Masters from the Salvos on the line. Gary, how are you?
Good evening, John. I'm well.
Gary, how's the appeal going? The Salvation Army is one appeal, the Red Cross is another. How are they linked?
Well, there's really no link at all between them, John. They're two totally different appeals, and we're very, very encouraged to see that the Red Cross has raised over $100 million for the for their appeal, and we're excited about that, but we're even more excited about the fact that a separate appeal, which doesn't have the national support of everyone, has itself raised over $10 million to date for the bushfire victims, and we're very, very pleased about that.
So that's just a local Victorian Salvation Army appeal?
No, that's Australia-wide. The Salvation Army across the whole of Australia has raised that. We're very encouraged.
Yes, it is an extraordinary tribute. How do you fit in then? Where does the money that the Salvos have got fit in with the rest of the disaster money allocation?
Well, that's a great question. And the good thing that we are really excited about with regard to the money that the Australian public has given to us is that we have a freedom to use the money as we see fit, so that we can help people as we see they need help.
So this will be a focus on the front line of just being able to get the aid out very quickly and directly to people.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, in the first 3 days of the disaster or following the disaster, the Salvation Army distributed $1 million to those who are on the field. They came in $800 or $1,000 grants to the people who had lost their homes so that they could go and buy those things that they really needed right then. Without any questions, you know, without forms of identification, because many of them didn't have those forms of identification, so they had money in their pocket to go and do what they needed to do straight away.
Thanks very much for that, Gary Masters of the Salvation Army. The Salvos Appeal and the Red Cross Appeal do give to both of those. Let's just wind this discussion up. We've rapidly run out of time. Steve Robinson, you've written about this, and you've written about the need for the wider counselling environment to take place. Yep. As you watch things this week unfold, what are the things that have most urgently occurred to you? What's the thing you've most wanted to say to people?
Particularly, I suppose, my emphasis has been on how clergy are cared for and how carers are cared for, and just being, I suppose, wanting to be mindful that there are mechanisms in place that people aren't being overexposed and that they're being well followed up, well supported. I'm thankful that in Victoria there is Victorian Council of Churches has a key role within the disaster plan, and that's some good training that's happened behind the scenes for those that are involved in that. So that's been my concern, and I hope that we don't give up within 2 weeks or so. Obviously, recovery is a long-term thing, and the resources are let in then.
Stephen Robinson is the author of Ministry in Disaster Settings, if you want to get hold of the book. Stephen said, for you, what's been the most important thing to come through?
I think that that reassurance of each other. I think that out of this terrible tragedy, we're seeing some of the wonderful things in human nature. And I think with the media, we were talking before how there can be a negative aspect of the media. I think a wonderful thing the media has done in the last week has brought these images to us. I think that has contributed to the generosity of people it's not just 181 people dead. There is these wonderful outpourings of human kindness and generosity, and that's inspiring us.
And Stephen Holmes, as a minister on the spot, what would you say to Australians listening tonight?
I would say, firstly, we need to congratulate ourselves for the massive outpouring of love and friendship. Just seeing in my own patch here, I've had about 50 or 60 workers every day working, sorting clothes and listening to the stories and seeing the camaraderie, seeing the new friendships. I mean, it's people have come from far as Sandringham, offers from Ballarat just to come here to Whittlesea to work.
And it's those new friendships you see arising and new relationships that might be established. And Chris Moran, I guess that's one of the things you'd like to emphasise. We're out of time.
Thanks to you all for being
with us tonight on Sunday night.